I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. Every morning, we awake to a world marvelously alive. Where do we encounter awe and wonder in this world? In animals and plants, in deserts, on mountains, in forests, ocean, and sky, in history, art, and science, in human striving and human kindness. Join us as we quest for the awe and wonder of knowing we are part of something infinitely larger than ourselves. You know the Salvation Army quite possibly from one of their local thrift stores, or maybe it's that you recognize their kettles, the red ones which reappear every Christmas season. But what you may not know is that the Salvation Army isn't just a donation spot. It's actually a church. The Salvation Army dates back to the 1860s. Londoners William Booth and his wife Catherine, the founders of the Salvation Army, set out on an ambitious mission to minister to people who might be destitute, drunk, or homeless, especially people whom other Christian churches were turning away at the door. These two good-hearted souls initiated a religious denomination that has now expanded to a membership of over 1.5 million worldwide. In our Constant Wonder quest for the wellsprings of awe, we sometimes reflect on an aspect that has been styled moral beauty. You could say that moral beauty produces a sacred sense of awe when we find ourselves taken aback by the sheer goodness of certain people, a morality made manifest in their courage, kindness, strength, or their success in overcoming big challenges. In this episode, we get to sit down with David Hudson, retired officer and former national commander of the Salvation Army in the United States. Not everyone has a story quite like Dave's, but somehow it's a life journey that strikes me as fully relatable. He quite simply strikes me as one of us. In his learning just to be himself in order to discover his talents, and then letting those talents guide him in bringing about good for others. The recognition of our own innate but often hidden potential can give rise to a wondrous sense of gratitude.
I love going to people that I find that are, I know they're totally opposite, and engage them in a conversation. And then you realize we have so much in common. To me, that's light. That's hope. Because if I can sit together with this person that's nothing like me, I don't understand much of their life. But we choose to sit down and say, let's hear each other's story. Let's just talk to each other. Let's build these bridges.
Dave Hudson was anything but a gregarious, outgoing kid looking to build bridges with others. In fact, he started out quite the opposite, so timid around others that he would gladly camouflage himself any way he could to escape from every sort of social exposure, which always left him feeling extremely vulnerable. His avoidant social manner in early life can easily be seen as the result of a troubled childhood and home life.
Yeah, let me just say that when my father was not drinking, I remember him as being kind. Unfortunately, those memories are not quite as plentiful. It's interesting for a child growing up in the home of an alcoholic, because that's all you know. You don't know anything else. I look back and there were some kind of funny times. You know, my dad came home one time, he was intoxicated, and he got the great idea of taking all the neighborhood children and putting them on top of his car, not in his car, but on top of his car, and was driving around the neighborhood. Now, that was not a smart thing to do. And it was all good until the policeman pulled us over and made us walk home. And today they would arrest him for that. And I don't know if they cited him or not. And there's so many stories like that where he just did things that were wacky that kind of on the surface, and let me emphasize surface, are quite humorous. But you dig down, they weren't. My first memory in life I think I was about 3, maybe 4 years old. I couldn't have been any older than 4 because that's when we left Dallas, Texas. Is the memory of him hitting my mom so hard that she fell over a suitcase and hit her head between the door and the floor. And later on, when I was older, I realized what it was. It was a suitcase, and she was trying to get away with me, and he came home and caught us, and so he hit her. And I have a number of memories of him abusing my mom, both physically and verbally.
Did you have siblings at this time?
I did, but my brother, he's passed away now, but was 18 years older, and he had joined the Marines. And my sister was 13 and a half years older. And because, I don't know if it was because my dad didn't have the desire to support her or they didn't have the ability, but she lived with my aunt. We were in Dallas. My aunt lived in New Orleans. So I was the only child home at that time.
So you didn't have a brother or sister to turn to confide in or to compare notes with or to commiserate with?
No, no. And again, you know, when you're really young, you don't think of things like that. You just think of how you're feeling. And I spent a lot of time, I think, hiding because when I saw him intoxicated or whatever, I just didn't want to be around him. If I would have been older, maybe I could have done things like standing up to him. And when I look back, that day may have been the single most traumatic day in my life. My mom and I had got away, and we were living in New Orleans, where my mom had a job, a nighttime job at a hotel that was 6 days a week. And so I was only able to stay with her one day a week. And then I stayed with my aunt, who was a Salvation Army officer in New Orleans at the time, the other 6 nights a week. But my dad found us, and he got us an apartment. And I don't know what led to this encounter with my mom and my dad. But I remember I was 7 years old. I was sitting at the top of the stairs, looking down the stairwell. And my mom and my dad were down at the bottom. And he has said that he is leaving us. That's how we got away. He is leaving us. And the last words I heard him say was, do you want the boy or do you want the dog? And I remember sitting almost emotionless at the top of the stairs and wondering which one my mom will take. Will she take her little chihuahua, or will she take me? When a boy hears that, what does he equate his value to? Well, my mom chose the boy. And I remember my dad taking the dog and leaving. And I didn't see him again for about 8 years until I tried to rebuild a relationship with him. You know, he had moved to Oklahoma City, and I was probably junior high or early years of high school when I tried to build a relationship. That really didn't work at all, and I only saw him like 2 more times ever after that. But no, it was a difficult time. If it hadn't been for my aunt at that time in New Orleans, I don't know what we would have done. It's my mother's sister.
She became a very bright light in your life, I understand. And you just alluded to it briefly. Flesh that story out a little bit more about what she offered you.
The one thing she taught me right away was structure. I mean, absolute structure. Before going there, I was 7, 8. I could do basically whatever I wanted to do, bring any toys out, go outside, do whatever. But no, you know, she said, one toy out of the box at a time, you put that back. We have meals at this time. All of a sudden, she started introducing me to discipline in a very, very positive way, which is a difficult transition for a kid that isn't used to that. But it's interesting, my mom was a wonderful person. But my mom, I don't remember her ever saying the words, I love you. I hear her say, I love my children. But I never remember her saying, I love you. But my aunt, years and years in the southern part of the United States, and part of her responsibilities was to go into Mexico and do audits for the Salvation Army units. And she did that for 30 years. And so she was fluent in Spanish. And when I would come home, she would always embrace me, and she would put her hands on my face, and she would look me in the eye, and she'd say, "Oh, David, yo te quiero mucho. Yo te quiero mucho. I love you, I desire you, I want you very much." And that was such a powerful thing, because I heard the words and I started to believe that I was worth, maybe I was worth more than that dog. My dad, the last time I visited him as a kid, he came home drunk, and I was in bed, and it was he only had one spare bedroom, and my cousin was in the same bed. We were probably 14 years old or 15. He was a year older than I am. And my dad came home, and you know, people are drunk. I think they think they're whispering, and they're not whispering. And I remember him saying to my cousin, "You've always been more like a son to me than my own boy." And I laid in the bed saying, you know, whose fault is that? And so I went to my stepmom and I told her, because while he was at work, that I want to go home. I want to go back home. And so 2 days later, I left, and I didn't see him again until after I was married. Now, I think it's important. He said my cousin was more of a son to him. My aunt, the last time I saw her, she had had a stroke. And she didn't speak hardly at all. She could, but she wouldn't. And so I went up to her hospital room in Portland, and I asked the family if I could just be with her by myself. What do you say to somebody that's been involved in every good thing in your entire life? She opened her eyes and she looked at me and said, "You've been like a son to me." Maybe I wasn't a son to my dad, but to this woman. You talk about influence. How do you measure that? I'm sorry, I still get emotional.
Influence, such an important word, and it's pivotal to what I had hoped to explore with you, this idea that other people can have profound impact, can have influence on us. Earlier, you said that when your aunt was kind to you, that maybe, and you used the word maybe, this was an indication that you were worth more to this world than just a chihuahua, right? And that shows such a contingency, such a tentativeness of expression that you were worth something. That goes back to this idea that you would hide. And I want to explore what you remember of just how it wasn't like, happy ending, my aunt loves me. It's not that simple. You were guarded, and the hiding. Give me some more examples of how you behaved.
I know that other children of alcoholic have similar things, but one thing you try to do the best you can is avoid conflict. And so you find ways of just not being present. Even after my dad left, for the longest time, anytime there would be arguments or whatever in the family, I would just go away. I think one thing that parents do is they instill in their children that they're worth something. And when you don't have that, you never feel like you're good enough. No matter what happens, you're not good enough, and you don't want to be noticed. It becomes, I'd say it's a gift, but it's not a gift. It's an ability to be in a very crowded room and going totally unnoticed.
Now, just in case it slipped your mind, this is still the origin story of a man who ended up with an appointment as the United States National Commander of the Salvation Army. Try hiding in a role like that, where things are totally the other way around. You gotta show up. It's a remarkable life trajectory of transformation in Dave Hudson, a complete life reset. And this is what led me to frame this episode as a story of moral beauty, and I'm hoping you'll bear that in mind. because the David Hudson I got to know is genuinely self-effacing, devoid of any bravado or braggadocio. If you want a character reference from him, he's not apt to help you. He doesn't seek the limelight. But a little later on, I am going to put someone on mic who would gladly shout about Dave's sterling character, shout from the rooftops. I've practically heard her do it, even though she's a very soft-spoken personality. But we're getting ahead of things, so I want to stick a little longer with David Hudson's formative years, specifically with a season of his emergent adulthood. He sometimes shares a very telling story about an incident he calls the lucky seat.
My mom and I were engaged in a Salvation Army church. We were in Portland. The Corps officer, the pastor, the Army calls him the Corps officer, was just an incredible influence in my life. He invested a great deal in me. Well, this pastor of mine, he asked me to come up. He said, Dave, why don't you come up and draw a number out of a hat, out of that, draw the lucky seat.
A little quick context here for you. The seats in the church were numbered, and at a designated time, a number would be drawn from the hat to determine a prize winner. So the pastor was simply asking Dave to perform that function of reaching into the hat and pulling out a random number. Nothing more dramatic than that.
And so I went up there, and oh my goodness, I'm on the platform. I went over, and I pulled the piece of paper or the coin or whatever it was, and I gave it to him. And I walked back to my seat real fast, and he read it out, whoever won. Well, after the Sunday school was over, I went to him, and I said, if you ever bring me up on this stage ever again, I will never come back. I will not come back. But you want to go unseen, unnoticed. Or when you are noticed, you want to do it on your terms, not on other people's terms. And, you know, that stayed with me for a long time. I mean, I was incredibly shy. Even when I was after high school, when I was training to be a Salvation Army officer, I was incredibly shy. I pretended I had laryngitis for 2 weeks to get out of giving a speech. And I, of course, I'm now 19, 20 years old or something like that. I didn't talk other than a whisper for 2 weeks because I didn't want to give that speech. Well, they found me out. You know, you can't pretend you have laryngitis forever.
Do you have any recollection what the speech was about?
I don't. And that's probably a good thing. You know, it's probably a good thing that that I don't.
You just remember the terror of it, right?
I do.
Now, what makes this memory so poignant for Dave is the sheer improbability that a person having had his rough start in life and a shy temperament should ever one day be given a role where speech giving and spoken communication generally are part and parcel of what you're supposed to do. When you're U.S. National Commander for the Salvation Army, you oversee all operations and mission fulfillment in the country, and this means you guide all internal and public-facing messaging. You implement policy, advocate with external agencies and governmental bodies. You meet and counsel people nonstop. And let's just toss in here the function of preaching and presenting in front of large audiences. Seems you're going to have to speak up a fair amount, and you're just not going to fare well with chronic laryngitis. Then there's also the matter of finding your way to a fulfilling private life. If you're no good at communicating, what are your chances of a romantic relationship? A little later, we'll hear from Dave about how the stars eventually aligned for him on that personal front. Right now, however, I want to pause to reiterate our aim in this episode. Awe is often ignited upon witnessing the goodness of other people. And I'm going to be very direct here. David Hudson is an extraordinarily kind man, as you're about to see in the following story. What made him that way is reason enough to stand in wonder, given the difficult early chapters of his life. I want to fold in a moment or two here for you to meet somebody who got to know Dave after he had already worked for some decades as a commissioned officer in the Salvation Army. This is Jess Scoville. She's still fairly new to our production team here at Constant Wonder, and a few years ago she found herself in the sphere of Dave's influence.
One of the absolute darkest times of my life, I had just moved across the country. I was in Virginia. I was thousands of miles away from family, friends, really didn't know anybody. And within a couple months of getting there, my husband decided that he didn't want to be married anymore and left me and my 7-year-old son and 5-year-old daughter. And I was completely bereft. I had no confidence in myself that I would be able to support our family. And if you've had something like that happen, it's devastating. It's terrifying. I hadn't had a job, you know, since I started having children, and I really wasn't sure what I was going to do. I applied to hundreds of jobs, and the interview that I got was at the Salvation Army at their national headquarters in Alexandria, Virginia. And I went to the interview, and honestly, I was so distressed. I mean, I was just shaking, and honestly, I thought I bombed it. when they asked me my greatest weakness, I said talking to people, which was part of the job. But they gave it to me anyway, took a chance on me, and did hire me for a very entry-level editing position. Not directly interacting with the national commander, but I was in the national headquarters. When I first started, I just sat at my desk maybe every day and cried. During an 8-hour workday, I'd cry for maybe half of it. And just kind of feeling the loss of just, you know, not only my relationship, but my dreams for my family, my hopes for my children. And I really isolated myself when I was there. My self-confidence was rock bottom. So I started working there maybe in the spring, and our first Christmas rolled around. The first Christmas I was doing on my own, just me and my two kids. Our budget in Virginia was insanely tight. I was so worried about Christmas. Not because there weren't people I could have asked for help maybe, but I wanted to do it on my own, and I wanted to be able to give my children gifts. Like, I had no idea, I think, until that moment what a big deal it was to me, until I was looking at the reality that, like, I had no extra money to give anything to my kids. I think, honestly, all I had was kind of a package of socks I was going to divide between them.
Christmas is a very big deal with members of the Salvation Army. Who knew? And Jess found herself invited to company parties, activities, receptions at Christmas time. And it was at one such event that she found herself, for the very first time, in direct conversation with Dave Hudson personally.
He came over to me and just said, "I want to shake your hand." And I thought, gosh, like, you know, he's in charge of millions of people. How does he even know who I am? He knew my name. He knew who I was. And when he shook my hand, he left a $50 bill. And I tried really hard not to cry in the moment. But when I got back to my office, I just absolutely dissolved. $50 at the time was everything. It meant that I could at least buy something for my kids to put under the tree.
There's a scene involving Dave Hudson that Jess loves to paint for people, and it's a scene that played out over and over again during her 6 years working there. Lunchtime would often mean walks with coworkers along the Potomac.
Dave came on a lot of those walks. Anytime we saw someone who was unhoused or clearly struggling, keep in mind we're close to D.C. There are a lot of unhoused people. And anytime he saw someone pushing a buggy full of stuff or who looked like they hadn't eaten or looked like they were in a bad way, physically, mentally, whatever. And sometimes these were people that probably even I would have crossed the street maybe to avoid, but Dave unfailingly went straight up to the person and said, "What's your name? Can I give you a hot meal? Can I get you somewhere to sleep tonight?" And that care and attention that he gave every person on the street, he gave to every person he worked with, just unfettered generosity.
Jess Scoville speaking there. Again, she's one of our producers for Constant Wonder. thousands of people beyond just Jess will corroborate Dave's uncommon selflessness, and they'll do it gratefully at the drop of a hat. But something came to light for Jess as our team was working on this episode. It's something that makes it all the more poignant to get a character reference about Dave from her directly. Think back to her job interview with the Salvation Army. Remember how she confessed then her greatest weakness, talking to people, but still got the job? In his youth, Dave would likewise hide from talking to people, but still got the job. That parallel was totally new information to Jess until Dave brought it up for this episode. I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. I've got another podcast to recommend to you from the BYU Radio family of podcasts. It's called The Appleseed. Each episode features master storytellers sharing all kinds of stories for you and your family, folk tales, fairy tales, personal and family tales. It's ideal for road trips, bedtime, or any time you're looking for something that the whole family can enjoy together. And here's a great side effect of listening to The Appleseed. It has a nearly magical ability to conjure up a whole lot of healthy storytelling right at home, and it often prompts the sharing of precious memories as well. Be sure to catch The Appleseed wherever you get your podcasts. We now return to Constant Wonder. So Dave Hudson's formative years were deeply fraught, with almost no self-confidence and a lot of social awkwardness. It was easier, he thought, to hide from the world than to face it. So it shouldn't surprise that his pursuit of romance seemed a big challenge to him. Because of his aunt and other mentors he met in the Salvation Army, this church had become a safe emotional haven for him. It quite naturally would also be the place where he would meet his future wife, Sharon. Before Dave describes getting together with her, though, you need to know that being national commander in the Salvation Army is not solo work. It's formally arranged to be a partnership, with a married couple working in tandem. The husband is designated national commander. The wife serves as national president for women's ministries. Dave and Sharon Hudson served together in that capacity from 2017 until their retirement in 2020. Was it the Salvation Army that brought the two together? Well, I can't really say if there was any actual active matchmaking by fellow church members, but the church clearly had provided mentoring, a place to mature and build confidence. And in this, there is clearly continuity with what he had experienced from his aunt, who had pointed him aright with discipline and encouragement and love.
You know, when you're teenage years or whatever, and I was living in those years with my aunt in Portland, and my mom was there as well, you're dependent on everything. And what happens is when you're on your own, you have to start providing for yourself. Then also, I think you kind of discover things about yourself that you can do, that maybe God has blessed you with or gifted you with. Maybe as a consequence of your past, all of a sudden, you know, you realize that I can do this really, really well.
So what you're describing is a classic pattern of people developing a certain competence in life. At the time of your marriage to Sharon, were you well on your way to having that kind of self-view?
I don't think I was well on the way. I had a couple things going inside of me. We talk about being shy and reserved and hiding. There's another fear that you have, and that's failure. You don't want to fail. I often joke about saying I'm motivated by guilt, you know, and I think some of that is absolutely true. I have worked because, one thing, my aunt was a very hard worker. She had an incredible work ethic, and I wanted to be like her. I worked very hard. I worked long, hard, you know, both as in the office or in the church, if we were in charge of a church or whatever, or with our family, worked very hard to be successful. Not only I wanted to be perceived as successful, but I wanted to be successful so that I could actually feel that I was measuring up. I was attaining something that I could be proud of and that my children could be proud of and my wife could be proud of. And you can't just be reserved all the time, hiding or whatever, and be successful. So what happens along the way is you start doing things that you should be doing. All of a sudden, there's some confidence that begins to build. And at first, the shyness is like a 10, and the confidence is a 1. And then you do a few more things, and the shyness is a 9, and the confidence is a 2. And someday, after a long time, finally the confidence is at a 6, and the shy is at a 5.
Graduating from high school, given his rocky start in life, well, that took confidence. And building on that success, he set his sights on more education, deciding to attend the Salvation Army College for Officer Training, which, by the way, is where he would meet Sharon for the first time.
The Salvation Army at that time had a school in San Francisco, and we both were in the same class. And so we spent 2 years together. And that's when we got engaged, is after school was over, when I asked her to come up to Portland. She's from Southern California, and I remember taking to a place where I used to ride my bike as a kid, and I asked her what she thought about if she would consider marrying me. And I was so pleased when she said yes right away. She didn't say, I'll get back to you or whatever. Yeah. But I do remember a conversation after we were engaged. I said to her, you know, Sharon, I will never leave you. And I'm not trying to be honorable or anything else, but I will never leave you. You may leave me. I will never leave you.
With a powerful promise like that, well, we already know where Dave was coming from.
My children will never know what it's like for their father to walk out on them. I don't care how old they are. They're in their 40s today. They will not know a father that leaves his wife and them. I don't say that again saying, boy, isn't he a great guy or whatever. It's not that. You don't have a model of what to be as a father. Charlie Munger used to talk about this. He would say, if you don't know how to be something, just think of everything that that person is not. And don't do those things. And you'll have a really good chance of being what you want to be. And I know that a good father doesn't walk out. I know a good father does not abuse their mother in any way. I know that a good father says to them, I love you. Every single conversation we have with our kids to this day, without exception, I love you. And one will respond either I love you too or I love you more. That is intentional. And it goes all the way back to, oh my goodness, over 50 years ago when I proposed to Sharon.
At its core, Dave's story is about self-confidence and learning to live up to his own best expectations of himself. It's a remarkable moment when someone realizes they no longer need to hide and that their talents might be of real value to others. Now, the interview I had with Dave, it wasn't a job interview, but I did ask him where he feels he truly shines.
I've always been focused on relationships. And, you know, that doesn't sound like a gift. However, it is amazing the things that you can accomplish through these relationships we're building. You start being able to identify what we have in common. You know, it becomes a bridge. And I've been gifted with being able to do that. Now, it took me a long time to realize that I was doing it. And then all of a sudden, I realized that this is a gift or a skill set. One story that sits out in my mind, and at this point, I was in Hawaii. So I'm in my early 50s at this time. We had this young couple. They had just flown onto the island to be in charge of our youth work for the Salvation Army. I was driving them from the airport to get their car so they could go to the house that the Army was going to provide for them. And she said to me, "Aren't you nervous about our lack of experience?" And I said, "Well, of course that's a concern. Of course. I mean, you're not going to lie to them. If you lie to them, say, well, no, I'm not concerned about that at all. All of a sudden they'll know, you know, you're not being honest." But I said, "One thing, I do know you, and I watch you from afar for the last couple of years. One thing I've learned is you're going to have people with abilities and you're going to have people with character. Hopefully people have both. But if there ever comes a point where you have to choose, well, this person has some more ability, but they don't have the character. And this person doesn't have quite the experience or the ability yet, but they have character. Always choose character, because I can teach ability. I can't teach character. You either got it or you don't." And from that conversation, we established this relationship. And I remember one day she came to me. She, at that time, you know, she's a breast cancer survivor. And she had been out for a little while. And she said something to me on the fact, "Well, why do you care so much about us?" Her husband and her children and her, "Why do you care so much?" I said, "Because, you know, you're worth believing in. And I believe you can do this." I remember another encounter I had with her. I walked into her office one time and I said to her, "Well, how have you failed recently?" And she said, "Well, I don't know if I failed anything." I said, "Oh, really? So you haven't tried anything new?" My point was, I'm giving you permission to fail. I'm giving you permission, because I don't care if you fail. As long as you're doing it for the right reasons, because you're learning, you're growing, you're developing. Those are important things. And I think that, no, let me correct that. I know that a leader, that if he or she can show the people around them that they're not looking over your shoulder, waiting for you to fail, but believing in you and willing to come alongside of you, that person will do everything in their power to succeed. And it's not about me feeling good or them feeling good. It's about accomplishing something that this world needs. And I think that we all inherently want to do good. I really believe that. But so many times, like people like me in my early days, I was so fearful that I would fail or I'd be seen or that I would just fall short of the mark, that sometimes I didn't try.
Yeah.
But to have a leader come alongside and say, "You know, I've got your back. Try this. And if it doesn't work, you know, like the Thomas Edison, I never failed. I just found 10,000 ways it didn't work."
It seems like what you're describing here is the Pygmalion effect, where higher expectations, well, that brings out a better version of the person that you're working with.
Yep. And I experienced it in my own life. Building confidence and growing isn't linear. You know, there's setbacks that happen all the time. And my wife and I, we had experienced 5 years of overseeing the youth work in Arizona, New Mexico, and part of Nevada. We felt like we had done a good job. The young people were certainly receptive and responsive, and it was a good time. And right after that, about a year after that, my daughter, who was a junior in high school, we found out that she was pregnant. You know, you want the best for your family. You want to escape all of the garbage that you went through as a kid and that your kids can have a better life. And all these fears came crashing in that, you know, here we go. You know, am I cursed? Am I absolutely cursed? I probably made it far too much about me than I should have, looking back at the time. But I felt like an absolute failure. "Who are you kidding?" I'd say to myself, that you could speak into the lives of these young people, hundreds of young people. You don't even have your own life together.
You were feeling like an imposter at that point.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It was just this horrible season. My whole time as Salvation Army officer, if I had an office, my door was always open. I was always welcoming people in. You know, come in anytime. Let's talk about whatever. My door for probably a month or two at least was closed. I just felt like a total failure. I'd go home and grab a sandwich and I'd go into our bedroom and I'd shut the door and I'd stay in there all night. Hated the morning because I knew that I would wake up feeling like a failure. I have a good friend that's a psychologist, and he said, Dave, this isn't a tragedy. You know, it's bad, but it's not a tragedy. But I had made it a tragedy because of, I think of all the garbage that still resided in me. And if I'm honest, still does to this day. I went into the office one day, and I went to my boss, and I walked in and said, why do you keep me here? Why? I'm not doing anything. I'm not accomplishing anything. Why? And he said to me, you're worth believing in. I said, why do you say that? And he talked to me about some things that he had witnessed in our journey together. And he just instilled in that moment that I was worth the investment. And so coming out of that season, jump forward would have been probably, I don't know, 10, 12 years later, where I'm saying to that young officer, you're worth believing in. Because I know what that's like for somebody to say. Because the scriptures say that God showed his love for us, demonstrated his love for us while we were still sinners. Christ died for us. Why? Because we're worth it. And as leaders, what a powerful thing to be able to work alongside your people, whether it's two or three people or hundreds of people, in ways to communicate to them that they are worth the investment. They're worth believing in. And yeah, I've been let down sometimes, but I tell you, far more times, people have not just met my expectation, they've exceeded it. And what a great time to celebrate. Celebrate them, not celebrate me and my belief in them, but celebrate them and what they've accomplished and what God has accomplished through them.
I wonder if you have in your portfolio of experiences, as you have worked in the Salvation Army, as you have nurtured relationships, as you've realized that you have some sort of calling or work to do on this planet, where you were caught up short and you thought, I scarcely have words for this.
The day I received my ordination, I'm so glad that I was assigned to this little tiny church in Renton, Washington that didn't have a lot of responsibilities. You know, just kind of keep the doors open and you succeeded. I'm glad that was it. And I'm glad God didn't say, and after that you'll do this, and after this you'll do this, and after this you'll do this. Ultimately, to this young man that's waiting to receive their first appointment, your last appointment will be National Commander of the Salvation Army. You'll be expected to go and meet with the President of the United States in the Oval Office. You'll be expected to meet with senators, members of Congress. You'll be expected to speak not to small crowds, but crowds of 1,000 or 2,000 or 3,000, and some of them bigger than that. I would have turned to walk the other way and said, boy, you got the wrong guy. If I look at my own life and I say, why? Somebody says to me, why do you believe in God and his goodness and his grace and his mercy? I say, because there is no way. There is no way that I could have done anywhere near what I was fortunate enough to accomplish, but because of a God that loved me and chose to believe in me. And you want to talk about being speechless? I don't have the words for that. I don't get it. I still have a lot of feelings, probably still buried down deep inside to me of that young boy, but I'm not the same person. I am not the same person. And it's not because of what I've done. It's because of what he has done.
One of the things I know about you is that you think it's important in interacting with other people who may or may not be in need, whoever they are, to name them, to call them by their names, to learn their names. Where did you stumble into that wisdom?
That was actually an interesting encounter I had a number of years ago. I was in San Francisco, California, and I was at one of our drug and alcohol treatment facilities, and I like going up and just chatting with people, and sometimes I'll say to them, so how'd you get here? What's your story or whatever? And I was going up this one guy, I was talking to him, and the guy that was listening in a little bit, you know, he kind of chimed in and he said, "Do you know the worst part of being homeless?" And I said, "No, I don't." You know, I came close to being homeless, but I was never homeless. I don't know. I don't. So what is the worst part? He says, "Nobody knows your name. Nobody knows your name." He said, "You know, I was walking down the street one day and I went up to this person and I asked them, what time is it? And they said, I don't have any money. He said, I didn't ask for money. I just asked what time it was. He said, do you know what it's like when you walk down the street and you see a person walk on the other side of the street just to avoid you? Do you know what that's like? I said, no. Nobody knows your name because you're not a person. You're not even an entity. You're just an existence. You're an inconvenience. And so I said to him, so what is your name? I said, my name's Mike. Okay, Mike, I tell you what, I commit to you this day. I will never forget your name. I will never forget your name.
Our guest in this episode of Constant Wonder, David Hudson, served as an officer in the Salvation Army for 45 years, including a tenure as U.S. National Commander, together with his wife Sharon, National President for Women's Ministries. Posts in which Dave and Sharon Hudson served together from 2017 until their retirement in 2020. If you're interested in learning more about the Salvation Army, we'll have a link for you on our website. Producer for this episode was Jess Scoville, who, as you have heard, was employed for 6 years at the Salvation Army's National Headquarters. And Jess was assisted by Madeline Rollins. Sound design assistance was provided by Gabriel Haro. If you've enjoyed this episode, please tell a friend about us, somebody who will really take joy in the stories we have to share. We're always wanting to reveal human creativity and kindness and our deep connection to the living world, all in a constant quest in search of transformative experiences of awe and wonder. We'd love to hear from you. Write to us anytime. Our email is constantwonder@byu.edu. I'm Marcus Smith. Constant Wonder is a production of BYU Radio. I want to take a moment and recommend another show from the BYU Radio family of podcasts, The Lisa Show. With life's great onslaught, everything that can overwhelm us and add stress to our life, Lisa Valentine Clark, her guests, and Council of Moms provide a practical, positive outlook on our ongoing daily challenges. They tackle problems head-on with wisdom and experience. You'll hear suggestions for better handling interpersonal relationships, useful ideas related to health, technology, body image, family, and a host of other important issues. It's called The Lisa Show, and of course, it's available wherever you get your podcasts.